Hello, I'm Nicholas Barrett.
Hello, I'm Gregory Kless.
Hello, I'm Simone Tagliapietra.
And you're listening to The Sound of Economics. Now, if you're a regular listener, you'll know that we've covered the European Green Deal in great detail over the last few months. And as you know, the European Green Deal is about creating a cleaner, greener, and more sustainable Europe and a more sustainable world. And you can't put a price on that, unless you're the European Union. And today we have a price. Simone, what is that price?
Well, first of all, the big news is that this week the European Commission has unveiled the proposal for a European Green Deal investment plan, which is supposed to be the investment pillar of the European Green Deal initiative, as we know, the flagship initiative of the von der Leyen Commission. Under the proposals advanced by the Commission this week, Europe is going to have an investment plan in order to put into practice the Green Deal, as well as a just transition mechanism to ensure the fairness of the process, particularly in coal and in coal regions and in carbon intensive territories. Now, the magic number that has been flagged by the Commission is 1 trillion euro. 1 trillion euro is the amount of money that the European Commission intends to mobilize, either in public funds and private funds, over 10 years. Now, of course, this looks like a very big number, but if you unpack this number and if you look at the investment requirements to get to the objectives of the European Green Deal, this is actually not that big. Let me just quickly explain why. First of all, the European Commission itself has made in the past estimations about which are the additional investment requirements to get to the current 2030 climate and energy targets we got in Europe. And the estimations are in the range of 170 billion to 290 billion per year. Now, as we know, under the Green Deal, the European Commission wants to raise the ambition for the 2030 targets. So the idea, which is also supported by the European Parliament, is to slash greenhouse gas emissions by 55% by 2030 rather than 40% as the target is today. Of course, putting more emphasis on this decade and making stronger the decarbonization in the forthcoming years will come at a cost. We can well expect the investment requirements to then go up to a level which could well be seen in the order of magnitude of 300 billion per year over the decade. So if you do the math, it's easy, of course. You see that the European Green Deal investment plan with its 1 trillion over the decade will actually only cover one third of the additional investment requirements to get to the new 2030 climate target of the EU. This is just to say that, of course, the Commission couldn't do much more, because given the limited size of the European budget, you can try to leverage it as far as possible to crowd in private investment, but there is a limit. And what they are doing and what they wish to do is already very ambitious. So they couldn't do much more than this. But here you clearly see the case that only countries and the private sector could get the transition really working, could really get the scale of investments that are needed to get to the targets we are setting with the Green Deal. So this is to say that the Commission, on top of what has been presented, now needs to work very strongly to unleash investments by member states, and the fiscal rules are the key there. So we need to make sure that the green investments will be exempted by the current fiscal framework in order to allow countries to make investments in this field, something that, as we will see, the Commission is still reluctant to do. And we need to make sure that the private actors, the companies, get a clear indication about this, the direction of decarbonization. And for that, a strong action is required by the Commission on carbon pricing.
Gregory, of course, late last year, you co-authored the paper How to Make the European Green Deal Work with Simone, and a big part of that was compensation for regions affected and, of course, the huge amounts of investment that need to go into decarbonising the continent. What was your reaction to yesterday's announcement?
It's true that on top of the investment pillar, there is a just transition mechanism pillar, which we think was really an important part of the Green Deal, because we know that climate policies can be very costly for poor people, and therefore they need to be compensated. And there are also like territories that will be affected, as Simone said, because they are very carbon intensive. And basically to give an incentive to some countries to commit to our ambitious target, we needed to convince them thanks to a just transition mechanism. So I think it's great that there is a good investment pillar, and also that they made some detailed proposal for the just transition mechanism. Then we looked into what this just transition mechanism will be, because this is actually where we got the most detailed proposal yesterday, because there is even a proposal for regulation. So there, even like there is a legislative draft. So that's good that they are already on top of this, that they already have a legislative draft. And basically, this just transition mechanism will rely on three main pillars. The first pillar is the creation of a just transition fund. So basically, the Commission, on top of what the previous Commission proposed in 2018 for the EU budget in the next 7 years, they want to add 7.5 billion euros for 7 years. So it's not that much. It's around 1 billion per year. And they want to create a special fund for the just transition. So where a country will be able to finance some particular project for territories that are heavily affected by the transition. So that's the first pillar, creating a just transition fund. The second pillar is to use a program called InvestEU in order to promote investment in those regions. InvestEU is basically the successor of the Juncker plan that was created in 2015 by the previous Commission. And that is basically using some EU budget guarantee to guarantee some project done by the EIB. So it's basically helping the EIB to invest more. And the third pillar is the creation of a public sector loan facility, also that will also be done by the EIB itself. So those are the three pillars. So I think it's interesting that that the Commission is making this very comprehensive with those three pillars. But then we looked into the detail of those three pillars, and then the details are sometimes a bit more disappointing. On the Just Transition Fund, as I said. First, it's not that big. It's 1 billion per year compared to a budget that is equivalent to 150 billion per year. You can see it's not that huge. And also, what is a bit disappointing in my view in this Just Transition Fund is the fact that the funds will be pre-allocated by member states. I think it's understandable from a political point of view, because as I was saying, we also do that to convince countries that were reluctant to commit to our ambitious targets, to convince them to do it. So it was important to pre-allocate it, to show them that some of the money will go to them. But at the same time, if you want to help the people who are in need because of the transition, it's better to react to some situation and not to have any pre-allocation. This is the case, for instance, with the European Globalization Adjustment Fund, which is a tool that has been created 12 years ago, and that is not pre-allocated. So every time there are some people who lose their job because of globalization, they can ask for that money. It would have been possible to do the same here. And basically, every time there is a region or a city or a country that loses a lot of job because of the transition, then they ask for the money. Maybe this would have been more efficient. So politically, it's understandable. But from a purely economic perspective, I think it would have been better not to pre-allocate.
Do you agree with Simone that this is only a third of the money needed to effectively decarbonize Europe?
Yeah, coming back to the investment plan as a whole, not talking about just transition fund. Our estimates from our previous paper show that this is basically only one third of the needs.
And it's still a huge amount of money. Where's it coming from?
It looks like a huge amount of money, but it comes from five different sources. Some of it comes from the EU budget, and basically by greening the EU budget, by going from 20% of expenditure related to climate to 25%. The second source is, again, InvestEU, so this tool that is the successor of the Juncker plan. The third source is national co-financing. The fourth source is revenues from the European emission trading system. And the fifth source is from the program that we already mentioned, which is a just transition mechanism.
Yeah, I think this list that Gregory just made suggests, I think, one important point, which is the complexity of this overall operation. Because as you see from the number of facilities and the different funding sources that are entailed, this really looks like a very Byzantine financial and administrative architecture. Some of the funds will be accessible only if done in tandem with other EU funding programs. So, for example, in order to get 1 euro out of the Just Transition Fund, a country will need to ensure they can get 1.5 euros from regional funds and from the European Social Fund. Plus, they will also need to show national co-funding. So, all these entails quite a substantial degree of complexity in really implementing these programs. So it basically means that a company that wants to apply for these, a region that wants to apply for these, will have to face this bureaucratic complexity and also the political complexity of finding different sources of funding at the EU level plus at the national level. So this is not going to be easy.
Wait, so let me get this right. So to apply for money from this Just Transition Fund, you have to have it matched by a regional authority and even bettered.
No, European Regional Development Fund,
right,
and by the European Social Fund.
And how big are they?
Because they want to leverage the 7.5 billion they are putting as fresh money into
because
the Just Transition Fund.
You need to realize that the only fresh money is in the whole plan is 7.5 billion. So we are talking about a 1 trillion plan. But what the Commission managed to fund for the moment is only 7.5 billion.
I mean, that's a very important point indeed, because the fresh money, as they call it, is the 7.5 billion of the Just Transition Fund. The overall idea here is to leverage with that small amount of money, much more money from other European pre-existing programs like the regional funds and the social fund, plus national co-funding, and in certain cases, like in InvestEU, private sector money. So here, the leverage that the Commission intends to have, it's really big, and that will be, of course, very challenging to get there, because with a limited amount of fresh money, you aim to get to 1 trillion of resources being mobilized by both the public and the private sector.
Yeah, and what I would say is the main risk behind this whole plan is that basically the Commission, to reach the 1 trillion, it will have to rely on other people. It will have to rely on national co-financing, so it will have to rely on the member state, and it will also have to rely on the promotional bank and among others the EIB, which will be very important in this plan. When I listed the sources, one of the main sources of funding is this InvestEU, and who is actually doing the investment of InvestEU? It's the EIB and the national promotional bank. So the Commission, because it has this very tiny budget, it has to rely on other sources of funding to reach that amount. And basically, they rely on the member state and on the public banks.
And by the way, I think it's also relevant to clarify that on top of the investment component, since the Commission is very well aware of the limited size of its budget, there is also a quite relevant focus on state aid rules. So basically, the Commission has unveiled a commitment to revise relevant state aid rules, basically in order of letting member states supporting certain sectors, from energy efficiency in buildings to the circular economy to the decarbonization of industry and so on, in order to try to be more flexible in the rules we currently have for state aid to unleash investment at the national level. So there is a recognition in the document that the job can only be done really at the national level and in the private sector. So there is also a look at the regulations we currently have in competition policy to allow that.
So we're using 7 billion euros to spend, unquote, a trillion euros on environmental projects over the 10 years. And all this funding basically relies on the continual kindness of a myriad of institutions and even some private sources for another 10 years. And presumably, if there's another recession in that time, another recession with contagion that spreads across Europe, a lot of that funding is going to dry up.
Well, as a matter of fact, half of the funding is coming from the EU budget, in the sense that 500 billion will come from the EU budget. But here we need to be very cautious about what do we mean for EU budget, because the 500 billion that the European Commission is getting out of the EU budget for climate and environmental purposes are not just investments. Those are money for everything, from research and innovation funding to the common agriculture policy. So you don't have to think at those 500 billion like fresh money available to countries and to companies to invest in renewable energy. That's not the case.
And also, that's not new from yesterday.
Exactly.
Actually,
exactly.
The previous commission, when it made a proposal about the next MFF, so the EU budget in the next 7 years, they had already committed to increase the expenditures in climate from 20 to 25%. So those 500 billion were already there.
So I think the bottom line here is the commission is, in my view, in good faith, really trying to do whatever it can to leverage in a sensible manner the limited resources it has at its disposal. What we learn from this is that really only countries and the private sector can deliver the carbonization and the investment requirements required to get to the targets we have for 2030 and climate neutrality by 2050. What we need to do is to let these people do their investments. And that's where the political problem comes in. Because as we mentioned at the beginning, what you need to do is to revise the fiscal rules in Europe, is to let governments spend if they are really making green investments. So once you have a taxonomy in place, once you clearly define what is green investment, what is not, you should let countries invest in the green infrastructure, also because countries are the ones investing in these public goods. So if you think about the electricity networks, for instance, right? So they should have more flexibility. But that's, of course, now a political taboo. If you look at the document of the Commission, there is a long section saying that there will be a debate about the new European economic governance, which might entail a revision of the fiscal rules in the future and so on and so forth. But basically, because, as we know, certain countries are opposing such development, and therefore the Commission cannot go in that direction. But this is really the discussion we should have in Europe. We cannot have the Green Deal put into practice if we don't change the fiscal framework we currently have, first. Second, we need to make a better use of the European Investment Bank. I think that in our European Green Deal paper, we previously analyzed the current portfolio of loans that the European Investment Bank has, which Gregory, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it amounts to 400 billion. And according to the current statute of the European Investment Bank, these can go up to 600 billion without losing the AAA. We should let the European Investment Bank invest more. And if countries, which are at the end of the day sitting on the board, are afraid about losing the AAA, well, they should recapitalize the bank in order to also seize the historical low interest rates we currently have. This is the best moment ever to invest because of the interest rates environment we have. We should seize it. And we are not doing that as of today.
But it's true that most of this plan is always leveraging a bit of guarantees coming from the EU budget to make the EIB do something. But if we want the EIB to do something, we should just ask the EIB to do something. The EIB is our bank, it's the EU's bank, and the people who are taking the decision at the EIB are the board of governors, and those governors are the finance ministers. So the finance ministers of the EU should go into a room and say and tell the EIB, okay, you need to do more in terms of climate. We don't need the EU budget to guarantee the EIB.
And again, you go back to the politics, you go back to certain countries opposing such development. And I think it's a news of yesterday. For example, from Germany, we heard a voice from the Ministry of Finance opposing additional funding to the European budget for the European Green Deal, as well as for the recapitalization of the European Investment Bank. So that's going back to square one, where the real political issue is.
Obviously, a lot of people who listen to this podcast aren't economists. A lot of them are in Britain. A lot of them are in America. Gregory, do you think it's worth reiterating why Germany is so nervous about rewriting their fiscal rules?
Because they're afraid that people will overuse them. And they're afraid of what happened in Greece in 2010, when we learned that Greece basically lied about its account, about its deficit, about its debt. And because of this actually small country from a corner of the EU, the whole narrative has been around that, about the fact that we were not tough enough, that basically countries that are not constrained take bad decisions and use badly their public finances. So I think this comes from there.
And could green investment become a way for countries to be fiscally irresponsible?
Not directly, but actually, as Simone was saying, the fact that now we have a taxonomy that is quite clear on what a green investment is allows us to say this is a green investment. It should be exempted from the rule, but only that investment should be exempted from the rule. You cannot take any investment and exempt it from the rule. Only the ones that are explained in the taxonomy and that are considered as green investment should be exempted.
And by the way, we have tools also to monitor what countries are doing. We have the European semester, we have the national climate and energy plans. So we have tools, governance tools, through which the EU could keep track of what countries are doing and therefore check that these green investments are aligned to the national climate and energy plans and so on and so forth.
Poland is the only European Union country who hasn't agreed to carbon neutrality by 2050. Should they get the money?
No, I guess it's more difficult than that. They said that for the moment they didn't want to agree, and I guess they were also waiting for this just transition mechanism to be explained and to see how they would get out of it.
We have seen today some enthusiastic tweets from Warsaw, from the government, about the amount of money that Poland and the Polish regions, coal mining regions, will end up getting under this framework. Of course, there are regions in Poland, as we know very well, that are subject particularly subject to the impacts of the energy transition. It's also true, and I think that's a broader question, that we need to be very cautious about defining which jobs will be lost because of the transition or because of something else. To be very precise, last year the GRC, so the knowledge center, let's say, of the European Commission, has made a study, and they come up with a number that in order to get to our climate targets by 2030, 160,000 coal jobs in Europe will be lost. But out of these 160,000, 110,000, so the large majority, will be lost in any case, simply because those jobs are not competitive anymore vis-a-vis, for example, Chinese competition. So we also need to be very careful about this new forthcoming trend of sort of green blaming, so to say, which might be used by politicians to get compensation for jobs that are actually not being lost because of the energy transition, but simply because of lack of competitiveness.
And coming back to the conditionality or the question if Poland should get it, actually, the proposal for the regulation contains some criteria. And for instance, one of them is that if you want to get access to the money from the Just Transition Fund, you need to submit what the Commission called territorial just transition plans. And basically, those need to be approved by the Commission before you can get the money. So you need to show that you will fulfill the target before you are allowed to get the
and
money.
And this is a positive conditionality in the sense that you need to make sure that you are not giving money to a region that on the other side is investing, for example, in coal mining or in the retrofitting of coal-fired power plants.
Yeah.
So you need to be policy consistency.
So you need to prove that you need it, and you need to prove that you will not do damaging things on the other side.
Exactly.
Because you're right that coal is becoming less viable every year. But of course, the timing here is very important. From a scientific perspective, how long can we afford to keep these mines open?
We have seen already these, for example, in Spain, there is a region, Castilla y León, that is a coal mining region, is an important coal mining region. 2 years ago, I think the region applied to the European Globalization Adjustment Fund to get financial support from the EU for the retraining and reskilling of the coal miners as the mines were being closed, simply because they were not competitive anymore vis-a-vis the Asian and the US, by the way, competition. So this is a trend that is there already, has been there for years, and it will simply keep pace in the future as particularly the cost of renewables will strongly decline, continue to decline.
And obviously, we've seen in the news recently, we've seen Venice covered in water, we've seen Australia covered in fire. Do you think these things focus minds? Have you been impressed by the sense of urgency in Europe of late?
In theory, these events should raise awareness. In reality, this is not evident. People might still perceive these as isolated, faraway events. So we clearly need to do much more to raise awareness. And what we could do in Europe is, for example, just to make an example of a very specific and small but probably important measure, promote carbon labeling. I mean, we need to inform people about the carbon content of each product we buy at the supermarket in order to get informed, to know which is the environmental consequence of our choice. And we have seen in the past in the EU and elsewhere in the world very good examples of energy labeling, for example, for electrodomestics and even for houses. And this worked, created a market for energy efficiency, for example. We could do the same for food products and for other products.
It could be mandatory, yeah.
Mandatory, absolutely, yes.
Yeah. The same way you see the dietary conditions of the food you're buying when you're in the supermarket,
exactly,
you see
exactly,
the labeling,
exactly.
You could see that for
the carbon footprint of that.
Exactly, yes.
So overall, having read these documents and looked into the proposals probably more in depth than most people, are you feeling more optimistic than you were 2 days ago, both of you? Either of you?
I think this commission is showing its commitment to this flagship project. And I really think that, as I said, in good faith, they are trying to do as much as they can with the limited resources they have. This is not sufficient. And only countries and companies, the private sector, can really get us to the scale that is required for this historical transformation. It's on them to take this not as the arrival, but as a starting point, and now on open the tables of the real debates, starting with the revision of the fiscal rules, carbon pricing, those are the key elements we really need to unlock investments in Europe.
Indeed, but you didn't answer the question. Are you feeling better?
So yes, I feel better, but we need to do more.
Okay, Gregory?
Yeah, I feel a bit better, but it's true that also, as we discussed, the Commission relies on many other players. So by themselves, they will not be able to do it. They rely on those players. If those players do not play the game correctly, like especially member states, which we mentioned sometimes were a bit counterproductive in their behavior, if they do not play by the rule, then it will not work. So it's not the Commission alone that will manage to do the European Green Deal. They will need the member state to play a big part.
Yeah. What should we look out in the year or so ahead to know if this is going well or not?
Well, I mean, we will need to keep track of all these initiatives being developed. We will need to look at the negotiations on the just transition mechanism, notably between the European Commission and the European Parliament. And the Council as well, of course. So the trilogue will be key, the negotiation at the trilogue on this. There are also other dimensions that will be coming up very soon. In March, we will have an industrial policy communication by the Commission, and we know that industrial policy is key for the delivery of the European Green Deal. So I think we have plenty of things coming up that we will certainly be following here at Brugge as well.
Great. Thank you, guys. Gregory Klase and Simone Tagli-Petra
are
both
Thank
on
you.
Twitter and both have work on the Brugge.org website where you can read how to make the European Green Deal work. Thank you very much for listening. You'll hear from me next time. Thank you for listening to The Sound of Economics. This podcast was presented by me, Nicholas Barrett, and edited by Tiago Almeida, and brought to you by the Brugge think tank in Brussels. To read our papers and blogs, you can visit brugge.org, and if you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe on Spotify and iTunes, where you can also leave us a review and let other people know that we exist. And you can stay up to date with everything we do by following us on Twitter, @brugge_org. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.